Welcome to Convergence. This is a show where ideals and reality slam together. The conversation's difficult, but now, more than ever, we need to have it. Hi, I'm Ellen Taylor, Executive Director, Station Manager of Archangel Radio, alongside canon lawyer Michelle McAloon. And we're going to bring you these conversations. Today, we're going to look at civil discourse. And joining us in a second is attorney Adam McLeod. He's a law professor at Faulkner State, and he breaks down his book, The Age of Selfies.
Good morning, Adam. How are you?
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you. I'm fine. Thanks. How are you?
Good. We are doing great. Talk to us about reasoning about rights when the stakes are so personal in this age of morality.
Yeah, we certainly have entered an age of what I would call moralism, haven't we? We're in a time now where we're hearing all the time about the various sins and offenses of our founding fathers and about things like institutional racism and various wrongs that are supposed to be or understood to be systemic and endemic in our culture and our political and civic institutions. And so there's this renewed awakening to the idea that there is such a thing as right and wrong. And this is really quite a radical break from what more or less predominated in the 20th century, which was something like a neutral public square, the idea that that our political discourse is supposed to be neutral. So if you think of sort of the icon of discourse in the 20th century, it would be someone like Walter Cronkite, sort of an objective observer who's speaking about important values like democracy and efficiency and democratic participation. And these are supposed to be neutral terms on which we can come together and discuss our important questions. And if you think of an icon for our current age, it might be someone like New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's much more comfortable speaking about evil and wrong and sins and offenses and so forth, using language that is actually somewhat similar to language that might have been used a generation ago by religious conservatives. But of course, she's directing it at institutions like private property and wealth inequality and so forth. And so this is a new challenge. It's a challenge that people who are committed to civic discourse have not faced in American history for the last couple of generations.
Okay, so we used to think of our rights as political rights and obligations as legal obligations that everyone agreed to. So now we're talking in moral claims and moral discourse. What made us jump the shark?
It's really interesting question, and I think there's a lot packed into the question. But I think the probably the simple answer would be that the political liberalism, the ideal of political liberalism or neutrality that so dominated the 20th century, it failed. It just failed. It collapsed. Now, I think the reason it collapsed is that people are naturally wired, oriented toward justice. People naturally want to do what is right, and they want the right to be vindicated, and they want wrongs to be sanctioned and remedied. I think that's built into human nature. And when there are, in fact, wrongs that go unsanctioned and unremedied for extended periods of time, people naturally become dissatisfied and restless. And so if we have this sterile, neutral public square where we're not allowed to talk about rights and wrongs, we're not allowed to, you know, smuggle in illicit conceptions of the good, to borrow from 20th century liberal political philosophy, then we're really sort of denying ourselves the resources we need to talk about what's most important in terms of our relationships with each other. We really are naturally oriented toward vindicating the right and remedying and sanctioning wrongs.
So, Adam, it sounds like what you're trying to say is that these are the same problems we've experienced in past generations, in past ages, but why does it feel so different today? It feels louder, it feels uglier, And so we're at a point now where all we're seeing is this ugly side of the discourse. But we
right about that.
Yeah. And we seem to be in a place where it just, we can't get past ourselves in this.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. I think two things have changed, and these are central themes of my book. The one is that we've lost the normative vocabulary. We've lost the intellectual tradition of thinking about right and wrong and justice, which had been sustained in the West throughout Christendom for hundreds of years by religious institutions, the church, by universities. And this is the tradition that goes back to Athens and the tradition of reasoning about justice, great philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and goes back to Jerusalem and the claims about right and wrong that are found in the Hebrew scriptures and then carried forward and perfected in the Christian scriptures, that was sustained for centuries by thinkers from Augustine to Aquinas, the great Christian jurist Justinian. And it used to be that we would read these people, we would interact with these people, and we would engage in this conversation with these great thinkers and recognize that these questions are not new, and that there are great ways of reading through these difficult problems. But we don't do that anymore, and so we've lost the vocabulary. So that's part of the problem. The other part is that everything has become personal. We live in an age when the primary moral objective is to constitute my own identity, to set up this image of myself, which I refer to in the book as the selfie, and to construct this out of the raw materials of the culture around me. And so a young person today might identify as, say, Jewish or Christian, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are taking into their own convictions and actions the teachings of that religious tradition and making them their own objective moral commitments. It's a matter of personal choice and personal identity. And then if you attack someone's beliefs, you're not just attacking their claims about what is true and right and wrong, you're attacking them personally. And so everything becomes personal, and that makes it very, very difficult to have candid conversations when we disagree.
You know what's really crazy is that we are less than two generations from this, because when Martin Luther King, as you point out, Adam, when he sat in a jail and wrote a letter about the evils of slavery, he was not talking about the political aspect of it or the political abuses. He described it as a moral wrong. And he refers to someone, this little known guy named Thomas Aquinas. That's sarcastic.
Yeah.
So what has happened is our moral discourse and our moral claims are no longer secure foundation of our ordered liberty and equal worth. They're missing the track when they try to collide with each other. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you think about the critical moments in American history when we've had radical moral disagreements, slavery in the middle of the 19th century, the civil rights movement to tear down Jim Crow segregation in the middle of the 20th century, you look at the writing, you look at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, you look at Lincoln's first inaugural address and his speech on the Dred Scott decision, and then you fast forward to Frederick Douglass, and then you read Harriet Beecher Stowe. You look at what King was writing, and in King's letter, he cites both Augustine and Aquinas, and he expects that the pastors and other civic leaders to whom he's writing know exactly whom he's referring to, and he's quoting them and counting on his readers understanding the significance of these quotations. And so there's a shared intellectual tradition as well as a shared moral tradition, which enabled us to reason through those radical moral disagreements in a way that brought clarity, brought more light than heat. That's what's been lost. And you're right. It's only two generations gone.
Right.
I feel like, too, Adam, that you've missed the crust of the argument is that that kind of writing can't be presented in 280 characters on Twitter,
That's true.
Our modern discourse has lately been broken down to.
Absolutely.
A zinger, a gotcha to put out there in social media, particularly Twitter. And so it just adds fuel to this fire of poor discourse without adding any sort of thought process or intellectual backing to it.
Because we attack the person and we don't see each other as rational agents. Is that right,
yeah.
Adam?
Yeah. Yeah. And technology certainly is playing a big role in this, no question. I think our economic opportunities present a big role for this. People move around a lot more now. So there's a lot less stability in terms of remaining in a community and having to get along with people over the course of generations. There's a lot to this culturally that's going on. I'm focused primarily on why can't we reason together mm-hmm. about what our rights are. So that's not to suggest that that's the only problem. There certainly are other aspects of the problem. And technology really, unfortunately, works to facilitate the worst aspects of this sort of selfies culture that I've described, because everything's a little bit artificial and everything's pretty abstract online, right? You can't really get into concrete details or make a sustained argument, as you say, on Twitter. And we're really not trying to be candid with each other online, are we? We're all trying to sort of project a sort of fabricated faux image of ourselves and put ourselves in the best light there. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we are all agents of reason. What we do is who we are. In canon law, that is one of the axioms, that mm-hmm. what you do is who you are. That is the truth.
Straight out of Aristotle, by the way.
Barry Way. Yes, it is. Yes,
I don't think half the people shouting things on Twitter or out in the streets of America these days recognize that point.
No, but what you're saying, Adam, is that if I am a selfie and I believe that I am a reasoned agent, that everything I do is reasonable, and if someone makes me mad and I don't agree, then I think whatever they do is unreasonable and they are not agents of reason. This is where we are.
Yeah, there's a certain sanctimony that comes with this moral certitude, isn't there? And unless I've actually done the hard work of understanding why would someone hold that view that I find abhorrent? What reasons do they have for believing, for example, that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, or that all natural persons, all human beings are deserving of the legal protection of the law? Why would someone hold that view? I find that just reprehensible. But there are actually reasons for holding those views. And unless we're willing to and able to understand reasons why people hold views with which we might disagree, or that might make us feel bad about our own personal identities, then we're not really actually having much of a conversation. It's just ugly shouting match.
Absolutely. And in your book, you describe four different moralists, or basically four different personalities. And you know something, we meet all of these people in society. We see them, they are a product of today. You know, the Christian, the person who supports transsexuality, the organic person, or all of these things, they have principled reasons. They believe what they are doing is reasonable, and what they're trying to achieve is, this little tricky word called the common good.
Yeah. And there are aspects of those views that I've laid out in the book which might not actually be true. So it might be the case that someone with whom I disagree, say, on the question of transgender rights, it might be the case that it turns out that their view is actually false, their view, say, of human nature. But it also might be the case that what they're trying to do to achieve particular legal recognitions for people who suffer from gender dysphoria is actually grounded in something important and true about the need for compassion, for example, or the need to distinguish between what's important and unimportant, relevant and irrelevant in making employment decisions. And it might be the case that even if I think their view is ultimately false, that I need to pay attention to the concerns that are at stake in their view with which I disagree. Now, it works the other way around as well. It might be the case that someone who is, say, a devout Christian or an Orthodox Jew who believes that for reasons of special revelation, they cannot in good conscience affirm certain claims made by sexual identity and gender identity advocates that they have good faith reasons for their refusal. They're not just being bigoted. They're not just being ignorant. And so we need to understand what would make them think that there is a rational design to the universe and that we ought to be faithful to the author of that design. Why would anyone find that a reasonable and plausible view? And it, ultimately, even if we decide, you know what, I'm not sure I actually do believe in a personal God, but there is something that might be good and worthwhile in affirming the possibility of rational human agency and design. And that's something that I might be able to learn from. So not to jump to conclusions about what people's underhanded motivations might be, or not to attribute to other people nefarious motivations, but to really try to understand what's motivating their position, even if I ultimately am not persuaded by it.
The underlying thing I'm hearing here, Adam, is a shockingly new word called compromise. That we seem to, not to put out there that you're going to compromise in your principles, but you're going to compromise in the small things, the things that maybe you can come to agreement or understanding with each other while still disagreeing on some big points. And it seems like we've come to a place in our society and the discussion on this that nobody wants to compromise on anything. And it becomes really hard, especially moral issues that people hold dear, in their heart. Like, I cannot not believe this. So how do you get to a point of compromise in a discussion today where people are not willing to compromise on small issues? Like you said, recognizing the humanity in the transgender person, but not necessarily agreeing that someone can actually change their gender identity.
I don't know, Ellen. I never agree with that statement, agree to disagree. I don't agree with that.
But how can you not? You may never change your mind.
But I think, Adam, what you're trying to say is what is really looking at the person and seeing what that person is trying to achieve, the good that person is trying to achieve. And then that's where the civil discourse can. So you talk to someone who supports transsexual rights. What they're really actually supporting is compassion and mercy for those who are different. So that is something that we can agree on in the common good. So that is the point of agreement that we have.
Yeah, so I think the kernel that's important to latch onto in Ellen's question is her distinction between, I think what she called small things and big things. We might call them peripheral things and central things, or the most relevant and the least relevant. So part of the problem is we've lost our sense of proportion. So if you're in conversation with the great tradition about reasoning practically, if you're reading Aristotle, if you're reading Aquinas, if you're reading Hebrew and Christian scriptures, it helps to pull you out of yourself. It helps to put your own identity and your own subjective experience in the broader context. And it helps you to understand the common good better, in a way that enables you to see what's really important and what's more peripheral. And then when we can understand what's important, we can insist that those important things not be compromised. We must never, for example, be willing to do certain actions. There are certain actions that we should just never compromise on. We should never sanction murder and raping and maiming. And we should never be willing to defame people and to attribute to them claims and motivations that they didn't have or make. There's certain things we should never be willing to do because it's unjust to that person and because it damages us morally, personally. It makes us worse off. Someone who lies becomes a liar in the act of lying. As you said, Michelle, a few moments ago, we are what we do. And so I think we've lost our sense of proportion, and so we've lost our ability, because we're not in this broader conversation about the common good, which has been going on for centuries now, as generations earlier were steeped in that conversation. We're no longer reading. We're no longer engaged in conversation with Aristotle and Aquinas and Justinian and the rest. And so we've lost our sense of proportion. And then the second point is exactly the one you make, Michelle, and that is it's really easy for me when I meet someone who espouses a view that I find objectionable to simply write them off as a bad person, right? They must have some evil motivation which would lead them to think something that's so obviously false or so obviously unjust. And rather, wouldn't it be better for me to try to figure out why they hold that view And is there anything in that view which actually does conduce to the common good? Is there anything that they think is important at stake? So, you know, in the book, one of my four moralists supports strict enforcement of immigration laws. And a lot of people today find that morally objectionable. Why would you want to keep out immigrants? And the point I make is maybe this person doesn't want to keep out immigrants. Maybe this person just perceives that there's an important value in the rule of law, that if we all are willing to follow the law, even when it's difficult, even when it's inconvenient, that we are all better off as a result. And so there's an important common good principle in the enforcement of laws. And if we need to change the laws, we should change them. Now, some people, again, might not be persuaded ultimately by that argument, but they should recognize that the rule of law is an important aspect of the common good. And on that ground, they can reason with someone with whom they disagree about, say, immigration reform, and really understand the concerns that are motivating that person's positions.
Absolutely. And so you talk about the collection of selfies and the personal, and you bring up a great example. So a 23-year-old manages to crawl up to the public library and check out Comenian Ethics on Aristotle. I think I just pronounced that wrong.
You are optimistic.
Yeah, I'm optimistic. And you know what? So he has his truth. He reads Aristotle's truth. He thinks he is just as smart as Aristotle. But Aristotle was a racist. He was a sexist. He was a pedophile. So therefore, anything that Aristotle says is absolutely untrue.
Yeah, and we can safely ignore it. And, you know, Aristotle was a bigot, so let's tear down all the Aristotle busts. I mean, that's essentially what's going on right
yes.
now around us, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
In layman's terms, we call that throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, what many of us who've been in the university classrooms have been witnessing in small scale for the last several years, this willingness of students to just completely disregard anything that came before because their views look different than mine, and mine are obviously superior because they're mine. Many of us have been watching this unfold in the classroom with increasing alarm over the last couple of decades, and now we're watching it play out in the streets. You know, it's not just statues of Jefferson Davis and Nathan Bedford Forrest that are being torn down. Mm-hmm. People are defacing monuments to the 54th Massachusetts and to Frederick Douglass and to Abraham Lincoln. And because, of course, you know, they're all racist. They all came earlier. They all must not be as morally in tune with, you know, with demands of morality as we are and justice. Well, it's obviously an ignorant, you know, ignorance is very much at work. But there's also this sense that, well, look, you know, I identify as this oppressed minority group. This person wasn't nearly as emphatic as they ought to have been about eradicating the oppression that people who identify in my group suffered. And so they just don't deserve to be held up as exemplars, even though they said these other things that I might like.
And they're doing violence, as you said, the debt we owe to others and the gratitude that we owe to the people, because we had to reason through those people, whether they knew it or not, whether we know it or not, to get where we are. So the J.R. Tolkiens, the Elizabeth Anscombe, we are standing on those shoulders now to understand what is racism. But it's really kind of a crazy irony that we are in now. And so,
Michelle, don't you know that racism was only invented right now? It's this sense of the immediacy.
The immediate, and it's only happening here in the United States. And you know what? Nobody else is racist around the world.
And nobody has ever experienced any of these problems in the past, in the entirety of mankind.
And this is the selfie, right?
Yes.
This is our reality.
Yeah, and in the book, I give an actual real-life example. It was an essay that I'd written for an online journal where I cite Aristotle. And someone wrote a comment in the comment thread below the article and you know dropped a four-letter word very dismissive of Aristotle because he was a pedophile. Now, the irony of this, there's several layers of irony of this comment, but it perfectly illustrates, I think, the phenomenon. So the first thing we have to note is both pedo and philia come from the Greek. And so if you're going to condemn Aristotle as a pedophile, you better not borrow his language to do it because you've already tossed him out. You've said we've nothing to learn from him.
Right.
If you're going to condemn him as morally unjust or morally unfit, well, on what grounds could you possibly do that unless you've already drawn the inference that someone's moral integrity is actually formed by their actions, that when they engage in certain activities like pedophilia, they become a pedophile. That becomes part of who they are. Oh, well, guess where that insight came from. That also is from Aristotle, so you can't use that. That's off the table. And now you're making a logical leap. You're making an argument. You're drawing a logical inference from his moral unfitness to his intellectual unfitness, and therefore we can disregard his arguments. Where did you get that idea of a logical critique of a moral? Oh, that also comes from Aristotle. So literally everything this commentator was using in this very short one-line dismissive backhand slap to Aristotle are all tools of language, logic, and reasoning that Aristotle himself gave us. It's an incredible, incredible ingratitude, an astonishing degree of ignorance, and really ultimately just it's self-destructive. We're kneecapping ourselves intellectually by being so dismissive of everything that's come before.
Absolutely. So now we are sort of towards the end of the podcast, and we are going to, in the next segment, talk about rights and duties. But if you are asking the bigger questions in life, what is right, what is wrong, what is good, you know something? You are smart enough to read Aristotle. You are smart enough to read Plato. You're smart enough to read Socrates. You might have to work through Aquinas, but that's okay too. You have that ability. If you have that intellectual curiosity, you have the ability. Don't ever, ever think that you cannot access these men, because these men, the reading is not light. And women, we've got some fabulous women out there too.
Especially in the native Greek.
Right, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't suggest reading it in the native Greek. And you might have to read it 1, 2, 3, 4, in my case, probably about 10 times. And you will get it because it is reason and it is logical. But have the confidence to do that. What are we going to do the next one?
Convergence. Look for us next, where all your shows are available. Podcasting.
Okay. And also, we'll be talking to Adam again in part two, right? About rights and duties.
You're listening to Michelle McAloon. I'm Ellen Taylor. This is Convergence, a product of Archangel Communications. We'll join you next time, Adam. We're going to continue this conversation and especially look at where we go from here now that we've laid out this problem. Thanks for joining us today on Convergence.